Hello, outdoor explorers. Glad you're with us today. Today's show comes from the archives. This show on glacier trekking first aired in June 2013. Enjoy.
A huge proportion of Alaska is covered with ice. Might be hard to believe on a hot day like this, but more of Alaska has ice on it than has towns or cities or any private property that would belong to you or me or be human dominated. That's a lot of country to explore, and it's so beautiful, like another world, blue and crusty and always changing, extraordinary. And I'm sure most Alaskans have stood on a glacier at one time or another. But today we're going to talk about traveling on glaciers, visiting glaciers, taking pictures of glaciers, what glaciers are made of, and how they work. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and our topic today is glacier trekking. And I've got three guests to talk about this. Christine Crossan is a UAA professor of glacial geology in the studio. Thanks for being with us, Chris.
Very nice to be here. Thank you.
Carl Battriel is a photographer from Anchorage who specializes in taking pictures of glaciers. Carl, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Gaia Mars is an owner of St. Elias Alpine Guides. She's joining us from, are you in McCarthy? Gaia?
I am.
All right. And is it just sunny and blazing there as it is in Anchorage?
Pretty much. It's actually a few clouds have come in today, but we reached a record high of 90 degrees 3 days ago, so pretty warm.
Amazing. So, Gaia, you lead beginners out on the ice, and I think folks who haven't been on glaciers are scared of them and think that, you know, this is a sort of a no-go territory unless you're an expert mountaineer. And there is safety that you need to know about. But tell us about taking beginners out on a glacier and what they need to know and what they learn when they're doing it and how long it takes somebody to be safe on their own.
Well, I think the first thing to tell people who are, nervous about the idea of walking on a glacier is I think they have a different image than what we've got here on the Root Glacier or other places where people do day hikes in Alaska. We take people onto the ablation zone of the glacier, and I'm sure our professor guest can explain more about that, but basically it's the part of the glacier where in the summer season there's no snow, so there's no secrets. People aren't going to be falling through some snow bridge into an abyss. We certainly have abysses, but they're easily seen and avoided, a big hole that you can walk up to the edge of and carefully take a peek into. You don't have to worry about things collapsing underneath you. So that's probably one of the biggest misconceptions about what we do. But, it's really, in a lot of ways, a walk in a very large park, so to speak. We, head up the trail and out onto the glacier, and we can take a route on the glacier that's almost like walking on the sidewalk, to be honest.
That's what I remember. You start out from Kennecott, you go up that road, and then it turns into a trail, and then the trail just sort of goes out onto the ice.
Yeah, it hits the moraine at the edge of the glacier and kind of wanders through that for a little ways, and then gets to the sort of toe of the white ice of the Root Glacier where we head out.
And you've got this amazing video that we put on our Facebook page at Outdoor Explorer of, I guess these are your clients who are jumping off of the ice into a melt pond and swimming.
Yeah, that was from this year. It's actually one of our guides, one of our first year guides this year, pretty excited to be here and decided to really feel what Alaska was all about firsthand.
I really recommend people to check that out. It's just go to Facebook, Outdoor Explorer, and take a look at this video, which is 3 minutes of a guy taking a swim on a glacier. You know, there's blue water. It's really cool, and it gives you a whole different conception of what glaciers are all about. Carl, you kind of, as a photographer, you've sort of devoted your life to glaciers. What is the attraction of traveling on a glacier? Why is that something you want to just focus on?
Well, part of it is that glaciers are always changing, so I can constantly visit the same glacier year after year, and it's always got a new surprise. It's always got new formations forming. I kind of call glaciers the slot canyons of the north. They have lots of different colors and textures, and it's endless, and there's so many options here in Alaska that Every time I go out, I'm surprised at what I find and the weird things I find. It's great. It's a lot of fun.
How did you originally get hooked?
I think like most, just like Guy was talking about, most photographers, I mean, most mountaineers and stuff in their early days, is I was really scared of glaciers. I thought, okay, I've read a lot of books and people fall in and they die and that's what happens on them. So I took a course on California's Mount Shasta on the Hotlam Glacier there when I was early 20s. And instead of being scared, I fell in love with the glaciers and stuff. And from then on, I went to the Cascades looking for glaciers, the Himalaya, and then finally I said, I have to live near them. So I moved to Alaska.
Uh-huh. And are you looking for the most challenging, most outrageous trip you can do, or are you looking for this beauty?
Yeah, I'm a lot different than most people that go out on glaciers. Most mountaineers kind of want to get through the glacier to get to the mountain. I'm the opposite. I'm not really after summits. I'm after the glaciers. I spend lots of time just wandering and waiting to find the right formation that I like, and then waiting for the light. I treat it just like any other landscape, and I take my time, and I just explore. I like the glacier for itself, and I'm not after summits or anything like that.
Uh-huh. Well, you were kind enough to lend us a bunch of your pictures, which we've put on our website, alaskapublic.org. If folks want to look at these, and I really strongly recommend that you do, go to alaskapublic.org, click on today's show, Glacier Tracking, and there's just some extraordinary pictures here. Some of which don't even look like they're real, and I assume they are all real.
Yes, they're all real. I don't manipulate photos or anything, so they are real.
Yeah, the colors are just mind-blowing. And there's this one picture we were talking about from the Mendenhall Glacier, which is, you know, a road glacier right outside of Juneau, where it's kind of surrealistic and kind of like acidy or something. I mean, like, what the heck are we looking at with this weird glowing and these weird shapes? Tell us about that picture.
Well, Mendenhall is really well known for having ice caves. For a long time, there was a lot of really accessible caves. These caves are formed by the water coming down from the side of the mountain and kind of drilling a hole under. And I went there, and that photo was in 2008, and a lot of the famous ones were melted away, so I decided to work my way up, and I found this cave. And it was perfectly round on the top, so I went in, and it wasn't very thick above me, and the light was kind of glow, making the ice glow from within. And then there's also a lot of light. It was a real sunny day, so there was a lot of light bouncing off the cliffs outside of the cave and bouncing into the cave. So it was really, yeah, it was, I spent way too much time in there. Because when you spend time in those ice caves, those caves are pretty safe, but some caves you feel nervous and you make quick work in there, and you get out as
it's moving.
Glaciers move, yeah. So you don't want to spend too much time in there. So I get in and I get out as quick as I can, but that cave was a little seductive. So
Wow. Chris Crossan, you're a professor. You study the geology of glaciers, and you must have a lot to do because all of Alaska is kind of glacier carved. I mean, one of the sort of the basic questions is why all these glaciers? If you go to the Arctic Alaska, the Brooks Range, there are few or no glaciers. There's tons of them here in coastal Alaska and in the Alaska Range. And then go a little bit farther south and the glaciers sort of give out. And I guess there's one on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington. But sort of like coastal Alaska is really glacier central. Why?
So most people think that to make a glacier, it needs to be colder. But the reality of it just needs to be cold enough. And so as you get farther north in Alaska, it's colder, but in south central Alaska, it's cold enough. And therefore, that means that the rain that falls and the snow that falls changes into ice, and we have a lot of precipitation. We have a lot more precipitation in coastal Alaska than we do in the Brooks Range, for example. And by the time you get down to the southern states or to the rest of the U.S., then there it's a lot warmer in the summer. So even if there's high precipitation there, things are going to melt away in the winter. I'm sorry, even though there's precipitation in the winter, things are going to melt away in the summer. So this is kind of the perfect situation for lots of glaciers. And I'm always surprised. I teach a class to a national audience on glaciers, and I'm always surprised that we do it in southern Alaska rather than northern Alaska. But southern Alaska is the best place, some of the best places in the world to see glaciers.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, obviously Greenland is covered with glaciers and Antarctica, but I don't think of Siberia as having so many glaciers, or Northern Europe.
So that has to do with the precipitation source as well. Just like the interior part of Alaska is colder, but it has almost no glaciers compared to southern Alaska, it's a precipitation source. It's those low systems that come off the Aleutians in the wintertime that dump all the snow on the coastal ranges and then on the Alaska Range going farther north. But even during the Ice Age, there was no ice in interior Alaska because of that rain shadow effect.
Interesting. So all this moisture is coming from the ocean, kind of these weather patterns that are sort of flowing in and running into Alaska, and they hit these coastal mountains, and that forces the moisture to condense and fall down onto the mountains, and so we get these huge amounts of rain.
Right, and even in the summertime, when you think, well, it's raining on the glacier, that might be melting the glacier, that's sort of like taking a kettle of cold water in the wintertime and pouring it into your snowbank. It's not going to make your snowbank melt. It's just going to make more ice on the ground. And so even in the summertime, when it rains on the glacier, sometimes that even adds mass to the glacier.
Mm. Well, I mean, the biggest glaciers around here, I guess a glacier is sort of like the river that's coming down the mountain, and then on the top of the mountain, there's often some kind of an ice field, which is more like a lake of ice, right? So the Harding Ice Field is one huge, would you call it a glacier, or it's one huge permanent ice that's probably been there basically forever, right?
Well, yes. We usually call those bigger, flatter plateaus of ice, ice fields, things like continental glaciers in Greenland and Antarctica, the ice fields of Harding and the Juneau Ice Field, et cetera. Yes, and those are flat, but that doesn't mean that the topography underneath them is flat. It just means that the ice is thick enough so that it covers up the bottoms of the mountains, and it covers up almost all the way to the top of the mountains as well. And in some cases, it'll entirely cover up a mountain.
So Carl just referred just a minute ago how glaciers are moving, and that's one of the sources of hazard. Do they move faster in some places than in others? And how do you know where it's moving faster and how fast it's moving? And how fast does a glacier move? About three or four questions there, so do your best.
Okay, so glacier movement is really dependent on how thick the glacier is, how long the glacier is, a lot on how steep the glacier is, and also how much water there is beneath the glacier. And so glaciers then have a huge variety of rates of movement, from pretty much no movement at all, where ice is just stagnant and it's sitting there and it's melting away year after year, to glaciers that will move feet per day in a surge like Bering Glacier a few years ago, when it was pretty much floating, if you want to think about it like that, under water that was subglacial water that was promoting very fast motion. So there's all sorts of varieties of length of glaciers, steepness of glaciers, rate of movement of glaciers.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth on KSKA Anchorage. We're talking about glacier travel, glacier trekking today. You just heard from Chris Crossan, who's a UAA professor of glacial geology. Carl Batriel is a photographer, and Gaia Mars is on the phone with us from McCarthy. She's with St. Elias Alpine Guides. And on our website, I've linked to several opportunities for beginners to get out on glaciers. As a former travel writer, I'm aware of some of the businesses that do this. And Gaia's business, St. Elias Alpine Guides, takes folks on a glacier there by Kennecott in Wrangell St. Elias National Park. Down on the Kenai Peninsula, there's a Godwin Glacier dog sled tour where you can go dog sledding on a glacier, helicopter to the dog sled. It's expensive, but pretty neat activity to do in the summer. Mostly done by tourists, of course, but there's nothing to stop Alaskans from doing it. Glacier flight seeing opportunities with Russ Flying Service and other local flight services. And one I didn't put on there, but maybe I'll do this after the show. I know Nova River Runners takes beginners out on the Matanuska Glacier for walks. And so I'm not trying to promote any particular business, but just let you know about opportunities to get into this. Tell me about the glacial terrain that you have there in Wrangell St. Elias and that you take visitors to, Gaia. What do people see when they hike over this? Are they seeing, you know, big crevasses and caves and all that sort of stuff we're talking about?
Yeah, we got lots of different stuff. So we take on our day hikes, we take people onto the Root Glacier. We also go onto lots of other glaciers on multi-day adventures, but for sort of intro level hiker or glacier hiker, it's the Root Glacier. And the route is great because it's got so many different types of features out there. Pretty much anyone who goes out on the glacier will see crevasses. They'll see blue pools. And an interesting thing about blue pools is there's a lot more of them in the spring and then a lot less of them later in the summer because as the glacier sort of opens up, again, probably getting into the science element of this a little bit, but as the summer goes on and all the melt with this hot water happens, a lot of those pools actually turn into moulins. And so throughout the course of the summer, we'll see less blue pools and more moulins.
And what's a moulin?
Water spills down into the ice.
Define the word moulin for us.
Pool. Basically, what's left when a blue pool drains out. So it's a big vertical hole into the ice. Sometimes they could be hundreds of feet deep, even here on our little glacier. So we have a lot of those. And then we have, you know, canyons carved by the meltwater on the surface of the glacier, waterfalls where those little streams go over an ice cliff. And those are some of the most common things. And then, you know, if you go a little further afield or have the right conditions, we do find caves and tunnels out on the surface of the glacier as well, which are pretty neat to explore oftentimes for the more adventurous or capable hiker. We can scramble into some stuff like that and see some of that beautiful blue ice up close.
What kind of training or equipment do folks need to do, just the kind of day hike you're talking about?
You know, the only technical equipment is a pair of crampons, which are those spikes, you know, we strap onto your shoes, just, you know, a client's own hiking shoes or boots. And other than that, you know, that's pretty much all you need to just hike up there. Of course, you know, water and lunch and sunglasses. That's not really technical equipment, but there's a lot of glare off that ice, especially on a sunny day. So sun protection is key, but nothing really too special aside from those spiky shoes.
At what level do you want to learn about roping up and learning self-arrest with an ice axe and some of those mountaineering skills? What do you want to, at what level of sort of trip or activity do you need those skills?
Well, we would only be using that kind of equipment on a mountaineering course or a mountaineering trip. So someone who wanted to learn to travel on snow-covered ice in a mountaineering-type setting could do a trip like that, either a course so they could learn more skills, or if they already had some basic skills, a trip, you know, where we climbed a peak or did some ski touring on a snow-covered glacier. But, you know, for most of the glacier travel we do, it's not necessary. And even on our backpacking trips that might be a week long, we commonly cross major glaciers. But as long as we're in that ablation zone where we don't have the snow, then that technical equipment like ropes and harnesses isn't necessary.
Does that ablation zone, is so it's melting at that point rather than accumulating, and therefore there's not snow covering the glacier. Does that snow line move during the course of the year up and down? Like winter, it's all covered with snow, and then summer it moves upward?
Sure, yeah. I mean, of course, in the winter out here, everything is covered in snow, but it melts off pretty quickly in the spring. I mean, even with the late spring we had this year, we were doing glacier hikes on May 24th. They had to walk around some snow patches. Anytime you have snow on ice, it's dangerous because you don't know what's underneath. So those first few days of the season, our guides were steering the groups around patches of snow, but as long as they had solid ice without snow on it to stand on, they were fine, and we were able to do that even in late May this year.
Mm-hmm. Is that Carl, do you avoid areas with snow on them? I know a lot of people traveling on glaciers, you have to go in the snow, right?
Yeah, I avoid them, especially since I often am by myself or just with one partner. And so I prefer the glaciers in the summer for exactly the same reason why the tourists like to walk on them, because that's when you can see all the neat stuff. I've been on lots of snow-covered glaciers, but all the features are hidden. So if you're a mountaineer and you're trying to climb a mountain, then having that snow allows you to travel quickly across glaciers. But for me, I prefer it in the summer months when the glaciers are free of snow so I can see the neat stuff. And safety-wise, I don't have to bring a lot of heavy gear because camera gear is heavy. So I try and lighten my load as much as I can.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, one of our Facebook friends, Jeanette, sort of chimes in, you know, this looks cool, but I'm finally enjoying the summer, you know, and thinking, like, who needs ice? And I could identify with that, but... But on the other hand, this is like something that's totally unique about Alaska and totally cool to be able to do. And really, most of us would not want to be on a glacier in the wintertime.
Yeah, it's. I was just I was on the Kalhitna in March, and we had ambient temperatures down to 40 below and a lot of whiteout and a lot of scary conditions. Some fascinating things, too. But generally, it's a different realm. It's for mountaineers. And like I said, it's... not the most beautiful time to be on a glacier. The most beautiful time to be on a glacier is when it's free of snow.
Yeah. Sometimes I wonder, you know, if people who are zooming around on snow machines and stuff even know if they're on a glacier. You know, there was this tragic incident that happened this year at the Arctic Man where a child just went down a crevasse on a snow-covered glacier, and you sort of wonder, do they know they're on a glacier? I mean, Chris, maybe, you know, Carl, anybody wants to mention it, but that happens, doesn't it? You can't tell.
Yeah, one time we were out of Whittier, up above the Whittier Glacier up in that network, and it was a big, heavy snow year, but up high on the mountains, we could see giant crevasses, the indentions of them. Mm-hmm. But when you're on the surface, you don't see those. And we were watching snow machiners go right through those big indentions, knowing that we could tell they were going right through crevasses, but they would have no idea. They would just think they were cruising along. Mm-hmm. So it seems to be that everybody quits snow machining on the glaciers when somebody goes in. And then all of a sudden, just like driving on the ice, it seems like once somebody pushes it too far, and then that's it. So.
Yeah.
Well, technically, that young boy fell down a moulon, and a moulon is a big round hole in the ice, and that one was about 15 feet across. So if that was covered with snow and that snow gave way beneath you, that would be a huge hole to fall into. Mm-hmm. And that is because a stream goes down a crevasse, and when it does that, it starts to melt the crevasse into a big round hole. And so, therefore, it's really dangerous. It's probably one of the most dangerous things you can run into on a glacier.
And is it usually like a round hole? Mm-hmm.
Usually, yeah.
And do people explore those? Is that something that, you know, go down and see what's down there?
Yeah, in fact, she leads trips down those moulons. I know the route has a lot of really fun ones that people climb. We've gone into them to find caves to go explore. But, yeah, I'll let her talk about it because I know she leads clients down those things.
Yeah,
we do. With our ice climbing trips, which is sort of the other thing other than just trekking that we do on the Root Glacier, if we've got some guests that are capable and doing a good job, we can lower them down into those moulons and they can sit down there amongst the beautiful blue ice and then climb their way back out. And it's really cool. And actually, there's some of our guides out there today on their day off doing that on their own just for fun. It's pretty amazing a place to be.
I have to admit, I think I would feel nervous. I'd have a combination of all of my different phobias. I'd have a fear of height going down there. And once I hit down there, I'd feel claustrophobic and I'd be worried about being crushed. So we're talking about glaciers moving. How do you know that it's not going to move right when you got down there? I don't know. Anybody who wants to chime in on that?
Well, I'll tell you about one of my experiences when I was in graduate school in Lapland. I was with a spelunker, a caver, and so we went down a moulon, and he said just what you said. Well, the glacier could move, and we could die, and some water could flood through here, and we could die. Do you still want to go? And, of course, the answer is yes. But, it's a possibility. But glaciers usually creep along pretty slowly, and usually it's not really something that you see or you feel when you're on the glacier except in an unusual situation. So it's fairly easy on a day trip or on a week trip to deal with the movement of the glacier.
Right. Well, the earth is moving. The crust that we're sitting on is moving. And they tell us, half an inch or an inch a year or something. On the other hand, it often gets stuck and then it moves a bunch at once and we have an earthquake. Do glaciers tend to move in a jerky fashion, or are they more sort of flowing slowly along?
That depends a lot on the situation on the glacier. There are some glaciers that move very, very regularly and very, very slowly. There are glaciers that are famous for things that are called surges, and those glaciers, like Bering Glacier, is a good example in Alaska, where for 10 years it has retreated basically and moved very slowly, and then within 2 years' time it'll move several kilometers, several miles ahead. So it's all that variation. People think that there's water trapped under the glacier in the situation for that very rapid movement, and that rapid movement stops when the water comes out in a great big huge flood out of the front of the glacier.
But if a glacier is surging, that's going to be pretty obvious, right? But if you're just on a regular sort of glacier that's doing its regular movement, you probably would never perceive the movement unless you had a time-lapse photography or something.
Yeah, that's true. And on a surging glacier, it rises up. It has huge crevasses all over it. It would be very, very difficult to deal with that in terms of a surface exploration.
Interesting. And here's a kind of...
Interesting side note about that regarding the Root Glacier here and actually the Kennecott Glacier. We have one event a summer where there's a lot of action on the glacier, and it's just very interesting. And that's when some of our ice dammed lakes here break, and specifically Hidden Lake, which is the biggest one here in the valley. It's and it creates what's called a Jökulsá, which is a glacially dammed lake flood, I guess, a flood caused by a lake breaking loose. And when this particular lake breaks loose and comes down, it comes through the glacier's plumbing system. And on that day, our guides out on the glacier say that very bizarre things happen. And that would be one day where I would not want to put someone down into a Mulan. Yeah. We have forewarning when that happens. The pilots can tell us when the lake is draining. But they say that Mulans reverse. I've seen it, too. Yeah. Mulans will reverse and turn into geysers on the glacier. And there's big shifts and movement out there. And nothing that's ever made anyone feel like they would be hurt just walking on it. But a lot of activity compared to your average day.
That'd be pretty cool to see. And I know there's a bridge that goes over that dry creek bed that fills up when the glacier opens up, which I've always thought was really neat. Neat to imagine it happening. I got to ask this one more a weird question, because I've always wondered about it. Since I've got Chris here, she has to answer my questions about glaciers. Is the ice actually sort of plastic and mold when it moves? You know, when I take ice out of an ice tray, it shatters. And it's hard to imagine something as hard as ice actually flowing or changing shape as it moves. Or does it sort of crack and then refreeze?
It does all of those things. So the deeper you go on the glacier, the more pressure of the overlying weight of the ice. So there's going to be plastic deformation inside the glacier and at the base of the glacier. When you get to the top of the glacier, there's more brittle fracture, and that's what the crevasses are, because you don't have the pressure of the overlying ice, and so you don't have that plasticity in the upper part of the ice. But those crevasses even are being carried along by the plastic motion underneath. So crevasses don't usually stay open for a long time. They'll open and they'll close if something gets in a crevasse, it's entrained in the ice, and it doesn't get out of the ice till it gets to the bottom of the glacier and melts out in a lot of cases.
Interesting. And I guess that plastic ice ends up being something good for Carl to take a picture of. Yeah. Well, I am totally into this topic. I could just keep going and blow off the break, but I don't think our producer would like that very much. So we're going to have a little break, and we'll be back talking more about glaciers in a few minutes. But right now it's time for the Outdoor Explorer Calendar. The Alaska Mountaineering School in Talkeetna has a schedule up for its 2015 mountaineering courses. During the winter, they offer guided glacier treks and ski trips in Denali and in the Alaska Range. In the spring, they have a full lineup of mountaineering courses. For more information on courses through the Alaska Mountaineering School, you can visit their website at climbalaska.org. The Mountaineering Club of Alaska meets the third Tuesday of every month. Meetings usually have a guest speaker who shares stories about mountain adventure, both local and from afar. The group's next meeting is Tuesday, November 18th at 6:30 p.m. at the BP Energy Center in Anchorage. For more information, visit mtnclubak.org. The Banff Mountain Film Festival is coming up in the new year. Show dates are February 15th in Fairbanks, February 25th in Sitka, and February 17th and 18th in Juneau. Anchorage dates are pending. For more information on the Banff Mountain Film Festival and where to buy tickets, visit banffcenter.ca. That's center, spelled Canadian style, C-E-N-T-R-E. And lastly, the Nordic Ski Association of Anchorage has its annual meeting coming up this weekend on November 1st. Music, mingling, and socializing starts at 4 p.m. at the Kincaid Chalet. Potluck happens at 6. The event promises door prizes and more. Visit AnchorageNordicSki.com for more information. And that wraps up the Outdoor Explorer calendar, updated for this 2014 broadcast of our Glacier Travel Show. I'm Charles Woolforth. Stay with us.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 9 o'clock on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. Welcome back. I'm Charles Woolforth. On today's show, we're dipping into the Outdoor Explorer archives to bring you one of our favorite programs on glacier tracking. But this part of the story is new. Alaska writers and naturalists Richard Nelson and Hank Lentfer are nearing the end of a two-year project documenting the voices of Glacier Bay. Animal voices, ice voices, all of it. The two adventurers hope to change how others experience the world through a dimension beyond what we can see. This report comes to us from APRN's Lisa Fu in Juneau.
In May 2013, Richard Nelson and Hank Lentfer set out into Glacier Bay, armed with recording equipment and a wish list of sounds. They spent up to 10 days at a time camped in the park, often waking up at 3 a.m. to the soundscape of birdsong. Since then, they've collected more than 1,000 sounds of the park, including about 100 bird species. Lentfer says they've captured the gamut of marine mammals, a range of terrestrial mammals.
And we've got things like glaciers and streams and rivers and melting icebergs that pop and bubble as they're melting. Just all kinds of crazy sounds.
Nelson says the Voices of Glacier Bay project was born from the premise that society has stopped listening.
We live in this world that's just filled with beautiful sounds, the spring choruses that we can hear in the forest, and the wind and the waters. We're constantly surrounded by sounds.
But, he says, we grow up in a culture that doesn't pay attention to them. In the field, the duo used sensitive mics and a parabolic dish that gathers and amplifies the sound. Often the best technique was proximity.
If you can get close to a single animal talking and get all the nuances and textures of its voice, it makes for a great recording.
But there are times when this doesn't work.
Like a thrush sounds best if you back off from it a little bit and get that rich melodic sound bouncing off the surrounding trees.
Nelson says the forest acts as a thrush's natural amphitheater and helps create a cathedral sound. An optimal time to capture this effect is after a rain or in the morning.
When everything's wet with dew and you have all these wet reflecting surfaces, so you might have a million little reflectors that bird is singing into, and all that comes back into your microphone and creates this amazing resonance that you just can't get if it's in a wide open place.
Of the more than 1,000 sounds they captured, Nelson and Lentfer each know instantly what their favorite sound is.
For me, it was coming down the bay in the skiff late in the evening in August, flat calm, the sun was going down, and we got into a channel between a big bedrock mountain and a large bedrock island, probably a mile and a half apart, and there were maybe 30 whales in there in three different groups.
Lentfer heard the whale's breathing, and what followed was the biggest sound he's ever heard.
So, of course, I get out the microphones, I get set up, and there's a boat in the background. It's like, oh, are you kidding me? You know, I can't record. Wait. The boat goes, get ready, another boat. But the whales keep making the sound, and finally the bay gets quiet, and they're still doing it. I hit the record button, The real joy of recording is it just locks you into the present moment. There's nothing but that sound. And you're just reveling in the beauty of it and a great fortune to be there in a place where those sounds still exist.
Nelson's favorite experience recording in Glacier Bay took place in June, on a day when he and Lentfer decided to go in separate directions. As Nelson kayaked into a small cove,
I saw an animal on the beach, and the animal turned out to be a wolf. I didn't have my equipment ready, and apparently the wolf didn't care. It started to howl.
Nelson moved toward the shore very slowly. He sat in his kayak about 50 feet from the wolf. It laid down, and Nelson waited and waited and waited. Finally, Nelson says both he and Lentfer feel an incredible sense of privilege for getting to do this work.
We are able to go into these places and hear the original voices of the North American land. Hopefully, future generations will be able to hear our recordings, and in a perfect world, people will be able to go back to these same places and hear these same voices 100 years from now.
For both men, there will always be the sounds that got away, like the earthquake in June that originated in Glacier Bay as both men slept in a tent miles from the epicenter. Or like the elusive wolverine, there are sounds they'll be chasing for a long time to come, possibly for the rest of their lives. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. Our topic today is glacier trekking, glacier hiking, getting out on glaciers. And I've got three guests with me. Gaia Mars from St. Elias Alpine Guides is with us from McCarthy. Chris Crossan, a UAA professor who studies glaciers, is in the studio, as is Carl Batriel, who's a photographer and really makes his living exploring glaciers and taking pictures of them. Carl, where would you go? I mean, what are your sort of... Okay, I'm a beginner. I'm not a total idiot. I think I can do this. Where would you send somebody to go for a hike on a glacier?
The most popular and the easiest to access on your own is the Matanuska Glacier. You can almost drive onto it, the relative dangers are low.
Are there some routes there that you can follow? Where you can
the front of the glacier, not the glacier itself, but the camping area is actually privately owned, and the individuals there actually cone out a route to a picnic bench out onto the glacier. So there's, you'll see people walking in heels and flip-flops, and then at the same time mountaineers with climbing gear. It's pretty interesting just to see the people. But
it's a beautiful and huge glacier,
it's
too.
It's a fantastic glacier. It's got a lot of neat features for photographers. And a lot of things to explore. The next one,
So let me just let everybody know, to get there, what you do is you drive up the Glen Highway, about 100 miles?
Mile 100.
Well, 100, okay. Wow, that was pretty good. then there's a pretty rough dirt road that goes down to the glacier, which is marked, and then you pay a fee to the folks who own that access, and then you can go take a look at it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, do you guys know how much the fee is these days? Like $10 or something?
$6, $10? Yeah.
It's more than that now.
Oh really? Yeah. You have to sign a liability release there too.
Right, of course. okay, your next suggestion.
And then the Root Glacier, of course, if you're out in that area, it's a farther drive, obviously, but the glacier's really fun to explore, and there's lots of features on there, more than I think even the Matanuska.
And you're talking about the Root Glacier out in...
Yeah, where guys
are from. Yeah, and man, there's no better weekend or maybe four-day trip you can make from Anchorage for like your highlight of your summer than going out to Kennecott, going through the mine buildings, the mine that was, copper mine that was there that was abandoned, I guess, in the 1930s, and visiting McCarthy, and fabulous mountain hikes to have as well. So, I'm with you on that one.
Yeah, that's a favorite.
So that's like probably most of a day drive.
It's a long way.
So you want to plan some time for that one.
Yeah, and there's a few others. A lot of people head straight to the Exit Glacier because of its it's on the map, it's obvious, but you can't actually go on or near that glacier. So people get down there and you'll actually get a fine, and you'll get in big trouble if you go on there.
There have been some years ago, there was someone who's killed there, a tourist. Yeah. Yep.
And then in the Worthington is another one they can drive up to, and I also don't recommend beginners going on that. It's a there was actually a teenager that fell into a crevasse, I think it was last year, the year before. It's a steep glacier, and I wouldn't recommend that either.
There's the one that's on the Richardson Highway right outside of Valdez, up in Thompson Pass.
And then the Mendenhall, obviously, down in Juneau is very popular, though it's also getting harder to access its surface. And then the final one that I like a lot that a lot of people don't know about is the Gulcana off the Richardson Highway. It's really a great mellow glacier to go on, and it's across this great suspension bridge over the river, and it's kind of an adventure to get to. It's actually near where the where Arctic Man is during the winter, but in the summer no one's going out there. I know that USGS, they study that glacier, and so does the university up there, but it's a great glacier to go on to.
So you'd go up the Richardson Highway towards Summit Lake, and where would you stop?
There's a memorial, Richardson Highway Memorial, and there's a dirt road right there, and you take that dirt road as far as you can go, as far as your vehicle will allow, and then you'll just hike up the road until you get to the bridge, and then you walk over the bridge, and it's a nice stroll up to the toe of the glacier, and it's an easy glacier to get on. And
I don't want to talk people out of going to Exit Glacier, though, because there's a really, really neat visitor experience there.
And the Harding Ice Field is fantastic, and you can go on that.
So what you do is you go down to Seward, and right before getting to Seward, Exit Glacier Road, which I think has been renamed like Herman Lehrer Road or something. Or anyway, you take a right next to the Resurrection River. It's 10 miles. Then there's a National Park Service Visitor Center. There might be a small fee. And got rid of the fee. You can walk right up to the front of the glacier, staying behind the rope so you don't get ice falling on you. And then there's a trail that goes up next to the glacier, which takes you to the ice field. Pretty steep, challenging climb, but then you're really up in the ice. Mm-hmm. Chris, do you have any recommendations?
Well, those are the safest and the easiest accessible glaciers. There are a couple more glaciers down in Portage Valley that are accessible up through Portage Pass and also just a tributary to Portage. And those are heavily used. Maybe they're not the easiest things to access in the world. And there are other glaciers that are up in the Alaska Range as well, next to Gulcana Glacier, that are, you'd have to be a little more adventurous in terms of being able to get off trails and go and find yourself. But there are other accessible glaciers like that.
So in terms of Portage, you'd go down to the Begich Boggs Visitor Center, and then there, I can't think of the name of that one that you can hike up
Byron.
To. Byron Glacier, right.
Yeah, so that's the one to the right when you're looking at the lake. And then if you go through the tunnel and over to Whittier, then you can go up Portage Pass, and you can hike up to Burns Glacier as well there.
Where's the trailhead for that? And it is a schwack now. They've kind of abandoned that trail, and it's a bushwhack to get up there. It's getting harder and harder, I think. But yeah, you go through the tunnel, and right after the tunnel on the right is the trailhead. There's a little road, and you follow it up.
Yeah. What about Eklutna? How close can you get to that one?
The Eklutna Glacier is way back there, and it's becoming, it's not recommended for beginners to go up there. The Raven Glacier is a better option Crow Pass. If you go up higher, you can get on it pretty easily. Starting from the Girdwood end. And that's a fantastic area to get the whole landscape of glaciers. You got all the everything that the glacier carves and creates is right there in that little area. And it's beautiful. It's well worth going to.
You can also go up the tram at Alyeska, and you can just walk up the road to the little Cirque Glacier that's up on top there. And I haven't been there for a few years, but it was pretty accessible last time I was there.
Ascending Path leads a guided trips from there using the gondola, and then they take people out on the glacier. So
neat. You know, I want to throw it open to you, Guy. Obviously, we've already extolled the Root Glacier and your tours. Put yourself now in the position of a visitor who's not going to go on a guided tour and is going up there and wants to maybe go just a little bit beyond the Root Glacier. Any accessible glaciers in your area?
I mean, nothing that compares to the route, for sure. I mean, that's a less than a 2-mile hike from Kennecott. So, and that is accessible. You know, there's no rule about having to go with a guide. If you're an Alaskan who's an experienced hiker and you got your own crampons, you can go out there on your own and poke around all you want. Other than that, I mean, if you're going on a backpacking trip or even a long day hike, if you're experienced, you could cross over the Root Glacier and cross over the moraine to the Kennecott Glacier. And then you can hike. We actually call it the Kennecott Highway. It's a really flat strip of ice that heads up the Kennecott Glacier towards Mount Blackburn that you can hike really easily and far and fast on. And so a lot of our, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 day backpacking trips end up in that neck of the woods. And that's kind of probably the next most accessible. Other than that, you'd have to, you know, fly in a plane, and there's lots of places in the park you can fly to, you know, with a bush plane and access other glaciers all throughout the park. We got hundreds of them, so.
Yeah, and my experience is that those pilots out there in McCarthy are more than happy to set you up with a route and help you figure out what you want to do, like Wrangell Mountain Air. And, I mean, that's a pretty good, for an experienced backcountry person, somebody who already has done some hikes off-road, they don't have to know everything, right? They can sort of access it through one of the air services in McCarthy. Would you agree with that, Gaia?
I would. You know, the thing about this park, even compared to other places in Alaska, is we really don't have any trails. So, you know, there's definitely a certain level of experience that I would say anyone should have. We get a lot of our clients come from the lower 48, and they backpack on their own all throughout the lower 48, but they hire a guide in Alaska just because there's so many factors they're not familiar with, glaciers being one. There's three main factors. It's glaciers, glacier river crossings, and bears. And those are the things that, you know, grizzly bears specifically, that a lot of backpackers aren't used to. But if you're an Alaskan and you're comfortable with those factors, I mean, absolutely, you can give Wrangell Mountain Air a call, and they've got a bunch of different routes they can suggest to you and tell you about, and you can head out there and see some of our hundreds of glaciers on your own.
Yeah, and I think I'd actually put river crossings at the top of that. I think that's where most people get in trouble. Carl?
Yeah, one other one I forgot. One other one I forgot is the Spencer Glacier, taking the train out there. I do that with my family every year. And even though the glacier itself is getting harder and harder to access, you got the big icebergs right there in the lake, and there's a group family campground right there, and it's a really fun place. And the train leaves you behind, and you really – so instead of flying somewhere, that's kind of like getting the same backcountry feel. You're left behind by the train and you're out there. So that's a good one too.
And everybody likes riding on a train.
Exactly.
It's pretty cool.
And I think you should mention that for people that are interested in to be able to go to Talkeetna and take in an air service and fly up to Ruth Glacier and be at the base of Denali is a wonderful experience
We're focusing too much on people who are very physically fit. Anybody can get on one of those planes out of Talkeetna, get there early in the morning as possible. Because that's when the flying is by far the best. And there's 4 or 5 excellent flight services there. I've flown with most of them. And it costs a lot of money, but land on the Ruth Glacier and get out and walk around. That is the most important part, because you have this amazing experience of just massive grandeur. Can't believe your eyes. And then you like fly down into it and you realize, oh my God, it's 100 times bigger than you thought it was, right? When you're standing there. So that's well worth it. Hey, listeners, please... you probably have ideas. I know our listeners have done most of this stuff. We'd love to hear your suggestions. Just go on our Facebook site and throw them on one of the posts that's already there and share some suggestions of where you'd like to go, where you suggest people go and experience glaciers. It's facebook.com Outdoor Explorer. So we've alluded to it just barely, Chris, but we want to make sure we get into this before the end of the show, which is that our glaciers are getting smaller. And in fact, you hear from tourists who are coming to Alaska when they survey them, well, why did you come? And they say, well, I want to see it before the glaciers are all gone. And somehow, you know, we're nowhere near the glaciers being gone, but they're shrinking. And some of them are shrinking for reasons that have nothing to do with climate. But overall, they're shrinking, right, because of climate change.
That's true. Most glaciers, I'd say probably 99% of glaciers in Alaska, are getting smaller. They're in retreat. We aren't a warming climate. It's the end of the Ice Age. The Little Ice Age ended about 100 years ago, and ever since then, since the 1800s and sometimes early 1800s, sometimes late 1800s, the glaciers have been retreating, and Portage Glacier is a good example of that. That doesn't mean, and that is definitely controlled by climate. Most of those cases, the glaciers are losing their mass due to melting, and of course, as it gets warmer, there's more melting. There are several glaciers in Alaska, however, that are entirely different types of glaciers. They are not melting back. They are not retreating. retreating. They are advancing. Those are some of the largest glaciers in the state. They are tidewater glaciers. They have a whole different system that is dependent on the depth of the water into which they are advancing. These are glaciers that calve into the ocean. It has to do with the sedimentation on the bottom of the fjord. And so those are very spectacular glaciers. You can see those in Prince William Sound. You can see those in Glacier Bay, for example. And there are several glaciers in Alaska that are still advancing, large glaciers that aren't just advancing for a year or two and then retreat, but have been in advance for 100 years.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at a glacier, you have to look at the mass, right? It's not just how long it is, but how thick it is. And that's not a simple thing to measure. There's a lot of technology involved in doing that. It's only in the last 10 years or so that we've really gotten very good at doing that, I understand.
Well, there are two glaciers in Alaska that are measured officially every year, and one of them is the glacier that was being spoken about before, Galkana Glacier. There's also another glacier that's about halfway between Anchorage and Seward, which is Wolverine Glacier, and those glaciers get surveyed every year. Someone actually puts a post on the ice, and they actually measure how much the glacier melts down every year, and they also put posts in the accumulation area, and they measure how much the ice accumulates every year, or how much snow is added every year. And then they have to survey the, not only do they know the thickness then of the ice that is lost or gained, but they also have to know the area that that covers over. And so compared to all the hundreds of glaciers in Alaska, that's a very, very small percentage of the glaciers. So there is some work that is being done via airplane where people mm-hmm. are able to use radar and determine how much the glaciers have decreased in volume over the last few years. And as you said, they've only been doing that for about 10 years. So we have some knowledge of the change of glaciers, but for the most part, we don't absolutely understand what's going on. But generally what you see out there is you see glaciers are in retreat. Glaciers are getting lower. Glaciers are getting smaller. That is generally the case.
Right. And but whether if a climate regime changes and we get more precipitation, then glaciers could grow. It's a, you know, that there's a, this balance of precip versus melting. So it's a complex story. But as you said, over a 100, 200 year time scale, there you see huge amounts of retreat. Glacier Bay National Park used to be mm-hmm. just a glacier. There was no 100 mile long fjord there. And right. If you look at the nautical charts of Prince William Sound, you see glaciers that came down to the water all over the place that are now almost gone. And that obviously didn't happen in a few years.
Right.
So you study that terrain that's left behind as well.
That's true. And what I started out being interested in here in Alaska is to date those moraines that are left behind, to know exactly when the glaciers, what time in the past the glaciers were large and how much they have retreated and how fast they've retreated. So, for example, Portage is a place where people know very well, and they're at the end of the lake. The reason the lake is there is because there's a moraine. That moraine dates to the mid-1800s. That's what the visitor center is built on. That's what the road is on, and the glacier's been retreating for 150 years. From that
right.
location, for example.
Well, I recall that when that visitor center was built, and I'm old enough to remember that, the glacier was right there in front of it, and it was supposed to stay in front of it for a while. And then they spent all that money, the glacier disappeared, they had to change all the displays in the visitor
That's
center.
Right.
Yeah. The glaciers mess with us. Carl, you make a living taking pictures of glaciers, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure a glacier or anything with snow on it is that easy to take a picture of. If you're especially with film cameras, obviously it took a lot of expertise to even get an image on that kind of white and blue landscape.
Yeah, in the film days, I hate to say that, but in the film days, your meters were pretty, the snow and the bright ice would often, you'd end up underexposing those, your photos. And with modern digital cameras now, you can check right away and make the quick adjustments.
What are the tips for getting a good picture?
Sure. Like if you're on the surface, if we're talking just the photographing the seracs and the pillars of ice and things like that, then it's very similar to traditional landscape photography. You like that early morning light, the late light. I tend to like to contrast sunset time with the coolness of that glacier to give that contrast is really nice. And then also I like glaciers in the fall when you have the fall colors in the background and the white ice. I like to mix those warm and cold colors. And then with the caves and stuff, people tend to use a polarizer filter a lot, or at least they think they need to because they want to remove glare and enhance that blue. But whenever I find that people overuse that with glaciers because there's a texture that is on the glacier. And when you use a polarizer, you kind of get rid of the texture. So you just kind of have a straight color. And that texture is what's so fascinating about a glacier. So unless I'm really deep inside a cave and I want to look into the ice, which is another fascinating thing, if you get into those caves, the ice is so clear, it hasn't been exposed to the sun maybe ever, and it's ancient, it's old, and it, you feel it, and it feels like it's rubber. It doesn't even feel cold. You can see in there, it looks like you're looking into the universe. It's pretty awesome.
And so then, it's super clear, you can see a long way through.
You can see rocks and little weird swirly things, look so deep in there, and it's amazing. You don't see that ice very often, but when you do find it deep in a cave, hiding in there, it's unbelievable. It's fascinating.
Yeah. Do you carry a light and set up lights in there?
I have put remote strobes deep into caves to help highlight them down lower into things. But no, the ice is too bouncy and reflective for lights usually. So you just kind of use amazing digital cameras. The digital cameras these days can do amazing things in the dark and the low light. So.
Well, it's interesting what you say about you don't need to exaggerate the colors. You don't need to go in Photoshop. I mean, they already look amazing.
Yeah, and people overdo. Well, man, we don't need to get into that topic. That's a different outdoor topic.
Yeah.
but they tend to overdo the blues and oversaturate when they really don't need to. I mean, they're fantastic on their own.
Uh-huh. And where do you sell your photos?
I sell my photographs mostly to magazines. I'm a project type photographer, someone would say. So I work on long-term projects. Right now I'm working on a new book on the Alaska Range. And I recently did a book on Chugach State Park. And so it's mainly project-driven concepts. So.
Give us the titles of the books where folks can get them.
Chugach State Park, Alaska's Backyard Wilderness, which came out in 2011. You can get that online. I think it's pretty much sold out anywhere in town. And you can get it on Amazon. And then the Alaska Range Project is my book project now. We're still taking the photos. And I leave Monday on a next trip. And you can go on my website, photographalaska.com, and go to my blog, the project blog, and read all about I write about photographing glaciers, photographing mountains, and I do trip reports from each trip. So,
and that's on our website, so you can find Carl's stuff, some of his samples of his amazing pictures, and a link to his work. And Gaia, if people want to meet you, they come out to Wrangell-St. Elias National Park, out to Kennicott. Do you need to make a reservation for these day hikes?
We prefer it if you do. Sometimes we can accommodate things last minute, but it helps us out with our planning and to make sure we have a guide available if you make a reservation in advance. And I was going to say, Carl, you should come out. We've got some pretty amazing caves out here, too. I don't know if you've been under the edge of the Root Glacier there where Jumbo Creek goes in, but wanted to throw that out as well.
I've been to that one. I've been there. It's a really it's a great spot, and I've never got to see the lake drain. That's one of the ones that I want to go photograph after all the bergs are stranded or whatever. Yeah, I'd like to go out there for that.
I'd like to see one of these geysers. Yeah. It sounds amazing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, great topic.
I want to climb onto the glacier on the day when I hear the lake draining this year and try to see it because I've missed it the last few years. But with the cave thing, I just want to throw out to the audience, too, we do have a cave exploration trip down under the glacier, and we don't throw it out there to your random couple from Iowa who's never seen a glacier. But for your Alaskan audience, that's for you. If you're an experienced hiker and you want to see something really different, we'll take you down into that cave and all that beautiful blue ice that Carl's talking about.
Sounds amazing. All right. Well, thanks, Gaia Mars, St. Elias Alpine Guides. Her link is on our website, alaskapublic.org, as well. Carl Battrell, photographer. Chris Crossan, UAA professor. Fascinating topic. I really appreciate you guys being here. Next week, we're talking about Mount Marathon. I'll be joined by Nancy Pease, who is a many-time champion of the race. I'm talking about her running, her skills. Matthias Sari, who won the race in 2009, has also helped work on making the race safer, and also an organizer from the race committee, talking about how the race will be a little bit different this year because of the tragedy that occurred last year. So please join us. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. I'll see you outside.
Out. Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to alaskapublic.org.